Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hey everyone, welcome back. I'm Kevin Cruz. Welcome to the LeadX Leadership Show, where we help you to fulfill your leadership potential. We help you to become the boss that you wish you always had. Today on the show, now this is special. You are finally going to hear from my personal leadership mentor, the person most responsible for turning me from the worst boss in the world into a best place to work winning boss. We talk about how rules take away choice, nature versus nurture, and because we really geeked out on leadership, this is going to be part one of two because we have so much to share. Now, before we dive in, I do want to remind you, visit leadx.org to check out the LeadX Academy. No hard sell today. It is just simply the best way for you to fulfill your full potential. Our quote this week is this: if you have 10,000 regulations, you destroy all respect for the law. Winston Churchill. Now, our guest today has studied great companies and great leaders for over 40 years. After 15 years as executive vice president of the Gallup organization, he co-founded Human Resource Innovations, which was later acquired by Conexa. Before Conexa was acquired by IBM, it had quickly become the largest provider of employee research on the planet. Our guest is currently a founding principal of Workforce Science Associates, and his new book is No Pegs, No Holes: The Psychology of Elite Performance. He's been my friend for 20 years now. Our guest is Bill Erickson. Bill, welcome to the show. You're not used to me being so official.
Oh, God, now I'm nervous.
This is going to make the B-roll, I think, all of a sudden. Okay. So, Bill, listen, I have mentioned, actually, my listeners know you, even though they've never known your name. So I've recorded almost 200 interviews. And I always talk about how when I was young and dumb in my early 20s, mid-20s, maybe I'm older and dumb, but back then, I had no management training, no leadership training. I was just this entrepreneurial driver winging it, and I was a horrible boss. I mean, the first couple of businesses didn't do that well. I had one employee threaten to beat me up in the parking lot, and he was right. He was right. But later in my career, I ended up winning a Best Place to Work award in the state of Pennsylvania. My employee engagement scores were strong. The last business in particular did very well. We had some success together at Conexa. And people say, Kevin, how did you go from like bad boss to like award-winning boss? And I say, I stumbled on a mentor. And I said, oh, wow. When I was the ripe old age of 30, my company got acquired, another company came in, and for the first time, I got exposed to some crazy ideas. Right. And I usually never mention your name, but I say there's one guy in particular who taught me 90% of what I know about leadership and engagement.
Okay.
And back then, Bill, I thought it was voodoo. You would say stuff that I thought was magic.
All right.
So my listeners, like, this is a big episode. After all this time, they get to hear from you directly.
Okay. I'll do my best.
All right. Now, but here's the thing. We do have a tradition on the show. I always ask everybody the same first question, which is, what advice would you give to a first-time manager, a young first-time manager?
Kevin, I love that question, and I'm going to make a serious effort to say something significant. But first, I feel just a little bit of an obligation to kind of alert people to all the myths that exist about management that actually make people worse instead of better. And I don't have time to do that, but that's where I'd plug the book. My book, No Pegs, No Holes, I have chapters on the myths about management that actually make people worse instead of better. But even beyond that, I'd like to alert people to this idea of sort of all the conventional wisdom that exists around management. Now, conventional wisdom is a little bit different. Conventional wisdom leads to conventional results. It shrinks everything to average, okay? The value in it, maybe it helps you avoid some pitfalls and problems, but it avoids elite performance. Okay. It gets in the way of elite performance. So if you want to have elite performance, you got to come up with some unconventional methods. Okay. So my recommendation for first time managers is a little bit unconventional. It's unconventional because it's not always fair. And people put a lot of value on fair, okay? And so here it is. And I can summarize this recommendation in one word, and it's a powerful word. And the word is individualize. People always underestimate the differences in human beings. Sigmund Freud, a long time ago, talked about a defense mechanism that he called projection. He said it's a natural human tendency to see ourselves in others. It gets in the way of great management. It interferes with great management because it's never true. No one is like us, okay? Now, so take something as simple as recognition, okay? There's, you know, a lot of people even deny that it works. They say, I don't need that. You know, that's not necessary, okay? You know why that is? That's because they have never been recognized in a way that fits them, okay? Everybody's different. You know, people who have the kind of ego that just craves a crowd of people and a standing ovation. There are other people, if you do that to them, it's the most embarrassing thing you could do. Some people have their trophy wall. They need another plaque or trophy to hang on the wall. Others take that plaque and put it in the bottom drawer, never to see the light of day. Okay. For some people, the best recognition they've received was actually a note of appreciation that wasn't even to them. It was to the people they love the most. Okay. It's different person by person. And that's true of every area. The way people define growth, for some people want to be the very best at one thing. Others need to learn something different all the time. For some people, it's about added responsibility. It's about earning your trust. People define growth in a million different ways. But what do managers assume? They assume everybody wants my job. It's never true. Now, one of the best interviews that I've ever given in my life was with John Wooden. I got to spend 1 hour one-on-one with John Wooden, arguably the best coach to ever live, okay? And he said one thing that I will never forget. He said, the worst form of discrimination is treating everyone the same. There's a genius to that. Now, you got to be careful with it, okay? But there is a genius to that. When you treat everyone the same, you miss the bullseye at least 95% of the time, probably more, okay? So my advice is individualize. Talk to your people, sure, but more importantly, listen to your people. Learn their hot buttons. Write them down. Take notes. Keep note cards or computer records to remind yourself. What are their hot buttons? What are the things that trip their trigger? Individualize. That's my advice.
Great advice. Again, and that's where... When we first met, so much of what you said, I said, you know, it was like voodoo or magic because it was not the normal stuff that everybody just tells, like, treat everybody fairly. You can't single anybody out, all that kind of crazy stuff. And this leads right to another one. back when we were together at that company, Conexa, early on, Bill, I'm writing a whole chapter in my next book about no rules, right? No rules, which again, okay. I have to thank you for enlightening me to this. And the story I tell in that chapter is when I sell my company to Conexa, and the CEO at that time was Rudy Carson. And of course, they're wooing me in, and I'm going to be a, you know, top 10 shareholder and a partner and, I don't know, VP or whatever it was. And everybody has a vote and all this stuff. And the very first time I submit an expense report, it comes back unpaid, rejected, with no information on it.
So I asked, did you ever watch a movie in your room? That was awesome.
Yeah. You know where this is going. So I ask our CFO of the time, like, what the heck? And he says, oh, you tried to expense Post-it notes. Well, we have a ban on Post-it notes at this company. So all of a sudden... I'm the partner. I'm an owner. I get an equal vote, and I can't get reimbursement for my $2 Post-it notes. And shortly thereafter, and I don't know if it was you or someone on your team got rejected because they were traveling and like bought a beer with their dinner at the airport. Well, we don't reimburse for alcohol, you know? Yeah. So this started the whole Post-it note, no beer at dinner war inside of Conexa. And this is when you taught the senior leadership and many of us that you know, the downside of rules are that every time you put a rule in place, you're taking away the opportunity for someone to make a decision, to have a choice, and it becomes their company, not my company, right? Tell me about, go deeper into this around like what rules have to do with this idea of psychological ownership.
You really highlighted it. I mean, but first of all, I got to say about rules, I'm not an advocate, but the first thing is, just so there's no understanding, every company has to have absolutes. They have to have principles that they stand for that are unbending, that are unbreakable, that are uncompromisable. You know, things like we tell the truth, we put customers first, whatever they are. That's a necessity. So, and you could call those rules, but they're what you stand for. Okay. And then I will say this. There are times when you need a lot of rules, and I will tell you what those times are. Those are when you find yourself in a situation where your people aren't very good and they don't care very much, okay? Then you need a lot of rules, okay? And you need a lot of enforcement and a lot of supervisors, okay? And it gets very, very expensive. But if you have good people that have the potential to make a real contribution and they care, then what you said is right. You've got to remember, every time you make a rule, you take away a choice. And choices are the basis, the cornerstone of psychological ownership. And you really did nail it. I mean, until I have choices and decisions to make, it's not my job. It's a job. It is not my company. It's your company. Once I have choices and decisions to make, that somehow magically translates. Now, all of a sudden, it's mine. It's my company. It's my career. It's my job. Whether I own a share of stock or not, it's still my company at that point. So one of the definitions that I really like about outstanding management is outstanding management is the appropriate distribution of choices, because that leads to big ownership. Okay. And if you've got people with the potential to contribute, who better to decide how to do their job? So, I mean, sometimes it's little things. I think in a great company, everybody, for example, ought to have the latitude to spend a little money without being scrutinized. I mean, I think people would be amazed at how appropriately that money gets invested, because they're close to the action and they know how they can spend a couple bucks to be more productive. They know that better than anybody else. Now, if you can't trust your people or not good enough, you can't operate that way. But if you get the right person in the right place, that's the way to go. And I don't think people realize that. I think that there are a lot of good people, great people, who get frustrated unnecessarily about things like Post-it notes, for God's sake.
And beer. More importantly, beer.
And beer. Yeah. So, I mean, what you said is right, and I can only kind of pile on.
Yeah, that was a big one for me. And then, you know, another area, I know we can go really deep into these things. But you write in your book, No Pegs, No Holes, a lot about, you know, people debate whether success, you know, comes from nature or nurture. They frame it as an either or. And you really make the point, it's not either or. So tell me about your thoughts on nurture and nature.
Yeah, well, this was really one of the things that was a turning point for me, and it is kind of a cornerstone in the book. There's this ongoing raging debate about nature versus nurture, which is more important, which is more causative. It really misses the point. Okay, so let's start with the nature side. First of all, just to clarify definitions, this is really about personality, and personality does exist. It persists. It even persists in most cases over a lifetime. It doesn't change. And if you try to change it, it is frustrating for both the manager and the person, because sometimes it can make you, first of all, at best, you're going to get a low return on investment. At worst, it's going to frustrate people and make them worse. Okay. You can't change Mother Nature. You can't fight Mother Nature. Now, I've worked with a lot of hospitality companies, for example. There's a lot of areas where this applies, all areas, in fact. Like, for example, in the restaurant industry, I always like to poke a little fun, and I always like to, everybody in that industry understands the importance of friendly service. They know that people will drive an extra mile or spend an extra buck to be treated the way they want to be treated, right? So I like to poke them a little bit about all the time, money, resources and energy that will be wasted in that one industry today trying to teach crabby people to be friendly, which never works. Okay. You can give them the technique, you can make them practice, you can make them memorize it and learn it, but it won't last. The real person is going to eventually come out. So the big idea, and this applies to so many situations, you want to have the friendliest service in town, hire the friendliest people in town. Okay. Now, then that's where the nurture side comes in. Okay. Because the nurture side is about all of our enormous capacity to change and grow and learn and get better. Okay. And when you hire those friendly people, the next thing that happens is your trainers become geniuses. Because everything that they do sticks all of a sudden. Any coaching that you do, any development that you do, it matters more because you're bringing out the best of who people already are. And that's powerful. But the biggest thing about nature times nurture, the biggest point that I want to make in the book is there's a magic to it. And that magic I refer to as the interactive effect. So here's what an interactive effect is. Let's say you want to lose a few pounds. Which I do, okay? So you hear about a diet, and the diet sounds, you know, there's some foods on there you like, and you think, well, I think maybe I can do that. And so you learn, if I stick to that diet, I can expect to lose a pound a week, right? And then you hear about an exercise plan, and it's like, well, that fits my schedule. Maybe I can do that. And if you stick to that, you can lose a pound a week. But what happens if you do both, okay? Do you lose 2 pounds? No, you lose like 2.5, 3 pounds, okay? Because if you eat healthy and eat right, you have more energy, your workouts are better, you burn more calories. That interactive effect is where the magic is. And when this nature times nurture thing, when that interactive effect occurs, it is a little magical. It is exponential growth is what it relates to. So it's when the natural traits, tendencies, preferences, instincts, relationship styles of the person find a match with the demands, the opportunities, the support systems that are available in the workplace. When you find that match, it's magical. That's when growth goes up exponentially. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not 5 + 5 = 10. It's geometric. It's not arithmetic anymore. It's 5 × 5 = 25. That's the power of it. And, you know, the good news is that match doesn't have to be perfect. If you're in a situation where there's some match, it is vitalizing, it is energizing, and you're better equipped to do the chores, the things that you don't necessarily look forward to. But when there's that match, you know, if you do those chores, you get to do more of the things you love to do, and you get a chance to practice and get even better at it. And it's exhilarating. It's vitalizing. So that's the real power of nature and nurture. It's when they interact appropriately, and you don't deny either one of them. You don't try to make one more important than the other. They both got to be there.
Now, I want to ask a follow-up and sort of challenge a little bit. You know, clearly from Gallup and others in the last decade plus, like the strengths-based leadership movement, very popular, sells a lot of books, a lot of training. Overall, I get it. I often feel like that is now being used as the just like the comeback from people who don't want to work on any faults or limitations. And I think, again, Bill, like it really is fun to talk to you like this because it caused me to think back to some of our early lessons.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I'll get the details wrong, but like you often would give lessons based on children and our children. You know, all this stuff works in our personal lives the same way. And, yeah. And I remember you talking about, you know, look, if you got two kids, you know, one's a strong reader, reads really well, reads really fast. Other one's not a strong reader. You know, you can try to make the not a great reader into a super reader and maybe they'll get 10% better. But like the damage and pain you've done to them and your relationship to them, is it worth it? And that same time could make the already great fast reader like exponentially faster. But I'm afraid people are taking this lesson and being like, I don't need to work on that. I'm only going to work on my strengths. You know, I don't need to worry about all the things I'm bad at. So how do you balance that out?
Well, you got to do the chores and you got to take out the trash. You know, the real value of that, the whole strength based psychology is it gets us away from remediation. Okay. And remediation is frustrating. I mean, if you've ever had to really focus on I remember teaching, and every year I'd have to meet with the principal and talk about my developmental opportunities, right, which were always my weaknesses, and it always came down to lesson planning, right. And it just made me so angry because I said, what do you mean I'm not I was up all night thinking about this. I know every kid. I knew when to use humor, when to use drama. I knew exactly what I was going to do. How can you tell me I'm not a good – well, what he was talking about was my lesson plans looked like I'd wrapped my lunch in them or something. And what he was worried about is, what if I called in sick and we needed a substitute, you know? Yeah. So we worked it out. I just made a list of films, and I said, if I ever get sick, which I hardly ever did, just use these, okay? And then he was okay again. But it gets you away from that remedial type of approach. But that strength-based approach is hard because people are who they are, and the work doesn't change, and the work's got to get done, okay? Yeah. So I think people try to make it about the job, okay? But it's also about the support for the job, okay? One way to build on strengths is to do what we talked about earlier. Find out, what are the hot buttons in people? You know, how do they like to be recognized? How do they define growth and learning? What inspires them? What makes their clock tick, so to speak? That's strength-based management, okay? Right. And you're not changing their job definition. And I think the other thing that it gets people thinking about that has enormous potential is the power of teaming, the power of complementary relationships. When your strengths and my weaknesses somehow compensate for each other. And so it gets you thinking about that. And it doesn't always work, okay, because there's not always the right compliments readily available. But if you're aware of them, and that's one of the magics of great managers. You know, the best managers understand the power of team. They understand the power of partnerships. The very best managers, if they play tennis, they would rather play doubles. Mm. It's more fun. It's more fun to play off of somebody else and to figure out, you know, that's how they think. And because they think that way, they see more of those matches. Okay. So that's the real power of the strength-based approach to me. Not that you're moving people around into jobs until you find the one that they love. You can't do that. But it's finding out all those little things that work for that person that hit on one of their preferences somehow. I think that's the bigger value and the more practical way to think about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hey there, LeadX Nation. We are going to pause this interview and call it part one. There's so much more good stuff that I've decided to break it into two parts. So come back next week. We'll dive into part two. Hey, before I go, I have to ask a favor. If you liked this episode of the LeadX Leadership Podcast, please take 1 minute and leave a rating on iTunes. Don't know how? Just open your web browser, type in leadx.org/subscribe, and it will bounce you over to iTunes. Just click on ratings and click some stars. Leave a comment if you really want to get crazy with it. And when you're done, let us know by sending an email to info@leadx.org. And we will send you back a special link that will let you in to our private VIP group on Facebook. Just in the last month, we sent out 2 or 3 dozen different books from our guests. We gave everyone free and early access to our new online personality assessment. And our VIPs even got to ask IBM Watson their management and leadership questions. I hope you have a great week, and I hope you will also remember that leadership is influence, which means you are always leading. This week, lead with intent.